Welcome. This is the Woodbury Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. We're glad that you tuned in, and if you'd like to know more about our church, you can find out all the information at woodburychurch.org. Or we'll see you some Sunday. Sundays at 10 a.m. Looking forward to it.
My name's Patrick. I'm one of the ministers here. I feel like I should introduce myself because I slipped on this coat jacket, and I had a couple people say, "What are you doing? What's going on there?" I know, I look pretty sharp, huh? Not too bad. I was debating. A round of applause, okay. I have a feeling that's sarcastic, but that's okay. We were having this big debate at home. I was like, "Crane, what do you think? Should I tuck it in? Should I keep it untucked?" You know, untucked is kind of my go-to, but tucking it in, it's Easter, it looks good. So I tucked it in, I modeled it for her, and she goes, "It makes you look like a middle-aged man when you tuck it in." We would not want that, because that is certainly not what I am. Glad you're here this morning. We're just gonna kind of jump right in, and just, I guess this is sort of the deep end a little bit. But have you ever had this experience where you're kind of minding your own business, and then out of nowhere, just nowhere, drop these existential questions? You're not thinking about anything deep or big. You're just kind of living your life, and then all of a sudden you're just like, "Is this it? Is this my life? Am I doing it right?" Now, maybe this morning you haven't had those questions because you were worried whether or not you were going to tuck your shirt in or not. But for some people, just laying there, they lay their head on the pillow at night, and as soon as their mind's undistracted, or maybe you forget to turn the radio on a drive somewhere, and you don't think about it, and there's this silence, and then these thoughts, these questions, just completely unbidden, come into your brain. And then, of course, we quickly try to distract ourselves with whatever trivial thing's going on. Now, Tolstoy, I read just this week, it's a really short little book, but he wrote a book called A Confession, and he's writing about his journey to faith. And in this book, he writes, it's just this unbelievable little guide. I'd totally encourage anybody to read it. It's online. You can read the text of it is online. But he writes this about his conversion, his situation before he found Christ is this. It was the simplest of questions lying in the soul of every man, of every person. It's a question without an answer to which one cannot live. So there's no answer, but you can't live without the answer. And the question is, what will come of my whole life? Why should I love? Why wish for anything or do anything? And then he says this at the bottom, is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me cannot destroy? This guy needs a long vacation somewhere warm, right? Not Russia. There is no real answer to those kinds of questions. Like, if you were just having a regular conversation with somebody and they dropped this kind of thing on you, like, is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me cannot destroy? You'd be like, you need a Snickers or something, man. You're going, this is a little too deep. But honestly, there are times in our lives where we're asking those kinds of existential questions. Where we're just like, is this it? You know, I wasn't sure. When I was young and full of hope, I thought maybe it would look different, or I thought maybe my life would turn out just a little bit differently, but here I am, and is this it? And what meaning and what purpose and all of that? Now, there's no direct answer to those kinds of questions. There really isn't. I mean, we could offer, we could talk, we could chat, and I could say, well, what about this? What about that? But there's no direct answer to those types of questions because they just keep flowing back. The only way you can address a question like that is by answering a completely different kind of question. The heart of Christianity is not a set of propositions or ideas. It's not a moral code. It's not a worldview. It's certainly not a political platform. It's not even a movement. The very center, the very beating heart of Christianity is Jesus. It's this person. It's this being. That's right. That's who is at the center of this thing. It's not a set of correct propositions about anything. It's about whether or not we understand or we're drawn to or we're trying to follow this person. And at the very center of Jesus is this question. It's no surprise. Should be no surprise to us today. But the very center of Jesus is this question. Did Jesus rise from the dead? That's at the very center. Every early Christian author claimed that he did. They all said that he did, and we saw him, or we talked to eyewitnesses, they record Jesus as having claimed it, and it's a crazy thing to say. It's pretty wild, and I realize that for a lot of us here, we've maybe grown accustomed to the uniqueness of that claim, but it's a pretty wild thing to say that he died, that they put his body in a tomb, they laid it out on a slab, they sealed the tomb, and that he was there for 3 days, and then 3 days later, he started breathing again, and his eyes fluttered open. That's a wild claim. If you're talking to somebody that didn't grow up around church or didn't grow up around Christianity, and you start saying stuff like that, it is strange. We're used to the strangeness, but it's a strange thing to claim. Luke chapter 23, we're actually going to be in the text of Luke, the resurrection account of Luke this morning. But in Luke 23, he records. Now, Luke isn't an eyewitness. He interviewed a bunch of people. He dropped names here and there so that if people wanted to go check on his story, it's kind of like a little bit of a footnote or a source. Go ask this person. And you'll see that throughout the story where he includes someone that you can still go talk to and find out, did this really happen? But in Luke 23, 44, it was about noon. And darkness came over the whole land until about 3 in the afternoon. For the sun had stopped shining and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. 46, Jesus called out with a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. When he had said this, he breathed his last. Lungs ceased to inflate with air. They buried Jesus. And then, very interesting, any account you read, the four Gospels, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, none of them record the main event, so to speak. There's no details about what actually happened. All you have is he breathed his last. We stuck him in a tomb. We had to do it quick because Sabbath was coming and we couldn't bury him on the Sabbath. And then some ladies go back a few days later to resume the project of burying him. And they're surprised that the tomb is open. There's no account of what actually happened, the details of what's going on behind the scenes. We don't get that. Luke 24:4, while they were wondering about this, suddenly, this is the women who had come to finish the job, the two men in clothes that had gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, why do you look for the living here in the cemetery among the dead? He is not here, he has risen. Such good words. They run back to Jesus' closest friends, who understandably think they're nuts, because that is a nutty thing to say. Verse 11, but they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. How often do you think those ladies brought it up and hung it over their heads? Like, you believe us now? You think we're telling the truth now? Huh? Next time there was a little dispute about a claim, do you think those ladies said, oh yeah, you remember that one time when we told you Jesus wasn't in the tomb and you thought we were saying nonsense? You believe us now? Now, Peter, however, he maybe had a little inkling of a doubt. Maybe some pieces of the puzzle were starting to fit together, and he ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away wondering to himself what had happened. So nobody really knows anything, and nobody's talking about anything else. This is just everything, every conversation that's happening around Jerusalem at this time has to do with this situation. Now, if I were planning the resurrection, if it were up to me, I would rent some billboards because I would know this is a big event. This is a paradigm-shifting, earth, worldview-shattering event. So I'd rent some billboards to let people know this is happening. I would promote it all over social media. I would have an event. You want to be here. You don't want to miss it. Now, the morning of, I would make sure to time the resurrection with the breaking light of dawn. I would not hide the fact that this has happened. I wouldn't just say he's dead and he's back. I would create an event around this happening, and I would gather an orchestra, a full, I don't know, 80-piece orchestra. I don't know how many people are in an orchestra. I would have a full orchestra, the big drums, what are those called, the timpanis, right? Something like that. I'm getting a nod or two. Yeah, I'd have the big drums, and what I would do just to create a little drum or a little tension is I would have them playing low. Right while everybody's gathering and taking their seats, I would have rented laser lights and smoke machines, and I would start a countdown. There'd be a countdown people could watch, and as it got closer and closer to the moment that I knew Jesus was going to be resurrected from the dead, the band would start to get louder. It would create this drama around this moment, and I would time it perfectly. I would have checked my phone to see exactly when dawn is happening, and I would have them play, what is that one? on in 2001, A Space Odyssey, where they're, you know, it's like dun dun dun, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, it would be a big moment. There'd be laser light, there would be smoke, and I would have Jesus. The tomb would be thrown away by, or the door of the tomb would be thrown away by hydraulics, and I would have Jesus kind of rising up from the ground amid the smoke. And the crowd would go nuts, and Jesus would roam around the stage. He would point at people. He would be, hey, I'm back. Here I am. You thought you had me. That's what I would do. Jesus does none of that. Jesus doesn't even go back to his closest buddies. He goes outside of town and talks to two guys who are going for a long walk, two guys that we haven't been introduced to before on this dry, dusty trail. That's where Jesus is. None of the smoke and lights and excitement and noise and orchestra. That's just not what he's up for. Luke 24, 13. I just want to walk through this story because it's so good. And it teaches us so much about not just the character of Jesus, but the impact that what he did had on your average, normal, everyday person, which, by the way, we are. We're your average, normal, everyday people. Luke 24, 13, now that same day, two of who? Just two new guys we haven't met yet. They were going to this village called Emmaus. It's about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. And as they had talked, they discussed these things with each other, and Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him. So there's something happening. They don't quite know who this guy is. He's maybe getting a little too close for their social bubble, listening in on their conversation. Who is this guy? And it's just, this is the event in history. No laser light show, just two guys. I probably wouldn't have done all that kerfuffle stuff with the orchestra and all that. I probably wouldn't have done that. What I would have done is I would have gone to Pilate, and I would have knocked on his door, and when he opened it up, I'd be like, surprise, remember me? I'm back. I would have gone to the Sanhedrin, to the religious leaders, and I would have been like, what are you going to do now, huh? You thought you could kill me? Good luck. That's not Jesus. That's not who he is. That's not his personality. He's just talking to two guys on this dry, dusty road. Now, there's a lesson in that line. They were kept from recognizing him. He doesn't want them to move past the confusion too quickly. This is really important, church. You got to know this, that God sometimes allows us to travel through confusion because there's an important lesson to be learned in that confusion, that if we just rush past that too quickly, it's no good for us. Verse 17, he asked them, what are you discussing together as you walk along? They stood still, their faces downcast. Jesus, of course, knows what they're talking about. They're talking about him. What are you discussing as you walk along? Now, one of them, named Cleopas, which, by the way, we can't go talk to him, but you could. Back the people that were reading this, they knew who this guy was. They could say, hey, Cleopas, we read the story that Luke wrote down. Is that true? And he could verify it for them. He asked him, are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened here in these days? What things? Jesus asked. What are you talking about? I don't know. I love that about Jesus knows. He's the one they're talking about. I love every piece of this. There's something about it that's so human and playful and even gracious. This is the biggest news in history. Jesus knows exactly what's going on. When I was studying through this, it made me think about this short video clip that I saw a few years ago. This is the first time you're ever going to hear a Easter sermon and reference Jay-Z. But it was a video clip about Jay-Z, who was making a documentary about, he's from Brooklyn. He had 8 shows at the Barclays Center that were sold out. I mean, he was trying, it was his hometown. He was declaring, I'm the king of Brooklyn. And so he's making this documentary about how Jay-Z is a man of the people. And he took the subway to his show that he was going to, you know, he was going to have the smoke and laser, and he was going to come up from a floor with hydraulics. I mean, he was the center of attention. And he's taking a subway to show that he's, you know, he's still got the street cred, I guess. Now, it happened that on that subway car was a lady by the name of Ellen Grossman, 67 years old, lived in Manhattan, happened to be on the same subway car as him. She had no idea who Jay-Z was. And this little clip, I mean, totally overshadows the rest of the documentary because she's talking to him. She can tell he's somebody. There's a lot. There's an entourage. There's security. There's people pulling out their cameras to take pictures of Jay-Z. Now, some of you are like, yeah, I don't know who that is. You know, you need to get out more. But anyway, Jay-Z is on this subway car, and it's just, she sits down and she asks him, are you famous? And at first he says, yes. And then he says, well, not really. I mean, you don't know me, so I've still got some work to do. And then she's like, so what's your name? And he's like, hi, I'm Jay. And they just have this really human interaction. And you can tell Jay-Z is totally amused by it. But there's this like this sort of noble humility in this interaction. Because he could say, Jay-Z has been nominated for more Grammys than any other artist in history, except for one, who has tied him. Do you know who the one person who has tied him for Grammy nominations? Beyonce. Some of you are like, I don't know who that is either. Well, yeah, come on. He could say that. He could say his wife is Beyonce, one of the most famous artists of this generation. He could say he's worth $2.5 billion, but he just says, yeah, my name is Jay. And they have this little interaction, and it's so cute, because it begins to dawn on her slowly that he really is somebody, but he's taking the subway, and she, this sweet little lady, turns to him and says, you know, I'm just really proud of you. And you can just see this little glow on his face. This famous person that doesn't need validation from a person on the subway, and he's just loving it. I feel like there's something like that happening in this moment with Jesus and these men on the road. He could just blow their minds, but he doesn't do that. And so what they say in verse 19, the second half, he says, so Jesus is like, oh, so what have you guys been talking about? And they're like, we're talking about Jesus. He was a prophet. He was powerful in word and deed before God and all the people, the chief priests, the ones that were supposed to trust with our religious direction and guidance, handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. We had hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it's the third day since all this took place. And they remember Jesus kept saying something about a third day. They didn't put all the pieces together, but there was something. In addition, verse 22, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, didn't find his body. They came to us and told us they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive, which begs the question, why are these guys walking away from Jerusalem? They've got some exploring to do. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see Jesus. And so these men stop in this conversation. They stop on the road, and they're totally discouraged. They're totally disappointed, and they're totally disoriented. And that is so relatable. It is so relatable in life to feel that discouragement, to feel that disorientation, to feel that disappointment. And like all of us right here, sitting right here in 2024, they only have secondhand information to go on. We heard some people looked at the tomb and there wasn't anybody there. We hoped he was the one. It's so interesting to me. Isn't it fascinating? We hoped he was the one to redeem Israel, and hope in bodily form is meeting them on the road. They don't know it yet, but he's walking right beside them, and they don't know it yet. Boy, isn't that symbolic of our relationship with God sometimes? He's right there. We just don't recognize it yet. We don't see it. We haven't seen the whole plan brought together yet. We hoped he was the one. Anybody here ever seen the movie An American Tale? Wow, you guys need to get out a little bit more. Oh, now you know. Okay, you see the poster, right? It was the defining movie of my life. It came out in 1986, so I was probably not born yet. No, I was probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, and this movie was so emotional. It sounds crazy because it tells the story of Jewish Russian immigrants coming to America in the 19th century from the perspective of an animated mouse. You're You're like, oh yeah, that sounds like it's going to be a bestseller, which is why some of you haven't heard of it. You got something to do this afternoon or this evening. Go watch this movie. So I think it's very formative for people of my age, because what happens at the beginning of the movie is Fievel, the little mouse right there, he gets separated from his family, who are all, you know, they're coming to this new world, and he gets separated from them, can't find them. The whole movie is about Fievel trying to be reunited with his parents. And there's several moments in the movie, and this is what just is burned in my memory, and some of you may remember this. Several moments in the movie where me, as the child viewer, who just longs for this family to be reconnected. You know the song Somewhere Out There?
Yes.
Okay, all right. We got one person that knows it. Thank you, Abigail. I appreciate that. It's such a beautiful song, and he sings it in his little squeaky mouse voice. I don't know how you... Anyway. So there's several scenes in the movie where you're watching this movie, and you can see in this one still of the movie, there's his family, and there's Fievel, and they're not seeing each other. They're like ships crossing in the night. They don't notice each other there. And you, as the viewer, you're like, they're right there. It's right there. Have you ever watched children's shows with your children? And like, you know, Blue's Clues? And Blue is like, where's the mailman? And the kids are like, they're right there in the window. It's like that. You're reading this story. We're seeing this story unfold. And these people, Cleopas and his buddy, they're discouraged. They're upset. We had hoped he was the one. And as we read it, it's almost encouraging us to shout at the page, he's right there. He's right there. You can't see him yet, but there he is. Acts chapter 17, Paul would take that idea later. It's not on the screen, you just have to read it. But he would talk to these people that didn't know God at all, and he would talk about how God had arranged their lives, where they were born and where they lived, where they grew up. He did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him. And then Paul tacks this phrase on the end, though he is not far from any one of us. That distance that we often feel in a relationship with God, that's a distance of our perception, not a distance of God's closeness or proximity. God is close. Jesus is right on the road with him. Verse 25, Jesus says this. He said to them, how foolish you are. That's a strange thing to say to a stranger. How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And then he does this amazing thing. He does a journey through the Torah, just like our church has been doing for 3 months. And verse 27, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said to him in all the scriptures concerning himself. They still don't know it's Jesus, but he's unveiling their minds. Now, this is so cool. He takes them on a 7-mile Bible study. What is that? 2.5, 3 hours? I don't know how long. I don't think they're jogging. I think they're walking along. 3 hours of a Bible study? That's a pretty long Bible study. But he's going through the story of Scripture, the Old Testament, the Hebrew covenant, and he's saying, like, listen, Jesus, he's a new Adam. He has come to reverse the curse that Adam and Eve introduced in the world. Jesus is a new Noah to cleanse the world from sin. Jesus is a new Moses leading people out of slavery into the promised land. He's the real tabernacle. He's the real dwelling place of God. He's the true sacrificial lamb. He's the true and perfect King David. He's the suffering servant of Isaiah. He walked them through the story after story after story and helped them see that this whole thing has always been about Jesus. It's always pointed toward Jesus. All those Old Testament stories that we love and we like to moralize, they're just shadows cast by the reality of Jesus coming to the earth. 7 miles they do this. Verse 28, as they approached the village to where they were going, I love this is again, Jesus continued on as if he were going further. He doesn't have any plans to go further. He's not going anywhere. But you could eat, okay, well, good talking to you guys. I'll see you later. I'm really hungry. Be great to have dinner, but I'll talk to you later. And the guys say, well, hang on. They urged him strongly, stay with us. It's nearly evening, the day is almost over. So we went to stay with them. And again, it's that kind of that playfulness, like, he's maybe, I don't know, toying with them sounds mean-spirited. I don't think he's doing that to be mean, but he's kind of just messing with them just a little bit. And I bet they're glad they insisted that he stick around. I wonder if they've ever thought, man, what if we just let him go? What if we just let him go on? Where was he going? Verse 30, when he was at the table with them, he took bread, and he gave thanks, and he broke it, and he began to give it to them. And it says it was at this moment. And I think this is so fascinating. Think about this. Jesus doesn't rip off the mask, Mission Impossible style, and say, hey, I'm Jesus, I'm here. He gives them tools through the Hebrew Bible to discover for themselves what is true. He doesn't force himself on anyone. He doesn't force belief on anyone. And then when they have this very human moment of breaking bread together, they recognize him. And then verse 31, Jesus does this weird thing again. And then he disappeared. Or are you not going to stay for dinner? I'm out. 32, and they asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures? It wasn't just pure logic. There was emotion there. I've been listening to these podcasts about fairly well-known intellectuals who have recently converted to Christ. These are, you know, maybe they're not like household names, but some of you may know like Peter Kingsnorth, Martin Shaw, Molly Wharton. They're historians and authors and just smart people who have in the last couple of years come to Christ. And this podcast is about their conversion. And by the way, if you're ever feeling discouraged, if you're ever feeling bummed out, if you're ever feeling like Jesus is distant, you should ask someone, anyone, about their conversion story. There's almost no better way to be reunited with the reality of God working in the lives of people than to ask them, hey, how did you come to Jesus? And to remember what it was like through their eyes. But anyway, this podcast is pretty interesting because there are these really smart, articulate people, and they almost all say the same thing in this process. They say, I spent most of my life thinking I had had it figured out. In fact, in some cases, just kind of dismissing the silly Christians who bought into this ridiculous notion that some guy rose from the dead. What dummies. I spent most of my life in that frame of mind, which there's some of you here thinking, I'm only here because my parents dragged me, or I'm here because I was invited by a family member. And the silly idea that Christians believe. But they all say that, and then they say something happened. I realize it's kind of vague, something. But what they're talking about is there was an event, some difficulty. They had some experience, some suffering. They had some epiphany. Something happened, and they learned that they really didn't know anything. And then they finally started asking those disorienting questions like we talked about right at the beginning, like what purpose or meaning is there in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me will not erase? And then they started realizing that this faith, this thing that they had so disregarded in their childhood and young adulthood, started to make sense. And none of it was like a flash of insight or a flash like, you know, of lightning on the road to Damascus. It was just it dawned on them that this thing is substantial and real. It was a slow process and it's really human moments and human thoughts. By the way, Tolstoy, who I read that quote at the beginning, same thing for him. He said, the belief that returned to me was not new, but quite old. The same thing that had borne me along in my earliest days, now I knew that without it, I could not live. It wasn't new. It was just reconnecting with something substantial and real in his life. Really simple human interaction. Jesus showed up before they realized he had shown up. Verse 33, they got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. Some of you would have been like, 7 miles in one day is pretty hefty. Maybe we'll just sleep on this and we'll go talk to the guys in the morning. No, you can't sleep on this kind of news, right? They returned at once to Jerusalem. They found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, it is true. It's true. The ladies who saw the empty tomb, Peter who saw the linen laying there, it is true because we saw him. The Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon. They literally did this 14-mile round trip. Now, I think this is kind of interesting. It's a little symbolic, whatever. Maybe I'm making too much of it. But the first 7 miles of that trip were disappointing and discouraging and disorienting. I bet you the second 7 miles of that trip, they were floating. Maybe they were running. They were walking on air because something had completely changed. It was the same road. It was the same circumstances, but they had a new reality with which to interact with the situation. And I think that there's a lot of people, the first half of their life, the first 7 miles of their life, maybe they grew up around the church, but maybe they wrestled with deep questions about how does this work and why are there so many Christians that I know that just aren't living out what it seems like Jesus is calling them to live out, and why are Christians so mean-spirited and what is going on, and is any of this even real? Is any of this even true? And then people have an experience. Maybe they struggle with some health issue or struggle with some big, deep issue in life, and they have some epiphany, some reality. Jesus shows up to them. It is true. The Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon. I mean, I wonder if anybody asked Cleopas and the other guy, who's unnamed, by the way. We don't know his name. I wonder if anybody ever asked him, hey, what's the most important day in your life? I wonder if they did, if they were to ask these guys that question, if they would turn to their wife and kids and say, hey guys, I love you a lot. You're really important to me. But the most important day in my life was that day we took a hike with Jesus. The most important event, the most pivotal event in my life was the day that Jesus confirmed that he had risen from the grave. I love you, wife. I love you, child. I loved our wedding day. I love the day you were born. But this is the most important day to me because this is the day that changed everything. This is the day that redefined everything. I'm going to say something that's going to sound crazy, especially for those of us who've maybe grown up in and around the churches of Christ. I believe we can meet the risen Christ. And I don't just mean like, oh, yeah, I will study intellectually and I will come to the conclusion that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. I believe that you can have a personal experience that confirms the reality of God and Christ working in your life. I believe that. And that's kind of crazy because we like to stick with the logical, substantive, show me. But Cleopas and his buddy turned to each other after they recognized Jesus and they said, weren't our hearts burning within us? It wasn't just a logical, that really makes sense. No, our hearts were burning. Some of you have had experiences that you can't explain. It could be easy to dismiss them as coincidences. It could be easy to dismiss them as some set of circumstances that science could explain, but I don't think that's the case. I think some of you have had an experience with the risen Christ. And he revealed himself to you in some way. And you know he is risen. You know he is real. I believe we can meet the risen Christ. In fact, I think we can expect to make Jesus to make himself known. Not on our terms, not on our demands. Jeremiah 20:19 says, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. Not like my kids seek their missing socks and shoes. I can't find it. No, when you seek Jesus, with all your heart, I believe you can expect him to reveal himself to you. So how about Tolstoy's questions? What will come of my whole life? Why should I love? Why wish for anything? Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me cannot destroy? Jesus says, what are you discussing as you walk along the road? What are you talking about? And I think he asks us that question too. One of those questions that swirl in your mind, like, why is this and what's that and who and where and what and how, why? What are you discussing? Some people have examined Christianity and thought, I'm not convinced. Some people have grown up around Christianity and yet still are discouraged and disoriented and disappointed. And I think our hesitancy with a relationship with God is packaged in thoughts like these. I don't think I like a lot of what the church has done and represented in history. I don't know that I want to be associated with that. I don't think I agree with a lot of Christians I know. I don't agree with the way that they present themselves to the world and the way that they vote and the way that they interact with their coworkers and families. Some of you may think, I don't know that I like how Christianity has packaged and fought culture wars in our society and gotten so upset about things that often seem so trivial. I don't think I can buy some of the scriptures teaching on things like money and sex. I don't know that I can buy that. I think I have some different ideas about the way things should be done. And people who wrestle with those questions, it can be intellectually paralyzing to grapple with all those individual questions. They don't know what to do. Because we tend to interact with Christianity in terms of, what do I agree with? I wonder what I think. I'm the final say. I'm the final authority. And I think we tend to interact with Christianity as a set of ideas, a set of propositions, as a worldview, a moral code. And Christianity isn't that. It's Jesus. It's Jesus. And you can take him or you can leave him, but you don't get to pick and choose. You can have him, you can walk along the road with him, but you don't get to say, Jesus, I'm not so sure. You know why you don't get to say that? Because if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, feel free. He made some good statements, he taught some good things. Feel free to just walk through scripture and select out of it what you like, because you are the final authority. If he didn't rise from the dead, feel free to interact with scripture any way that you like. Feel free to interact with the story of Jesus however you want. But if Jesus rose from the dead, then you have a lifetime to wrestle with those other questions, but it's a binary choice. Is he the one true king who has conquered death, or is he not? That's the choice. There's no middle ground there. And this is why I say at the heart of Christianity is Jesus, and at the heart of Jesus is this question that we can wrestle with. Did he rise from the dead? If no, whatever, details don't matter. Whatever promises he made don't matter. Whatever claims he made about sin and forgiveness and eternal life doesn't matter. But if the answer is yes, then guilt and shame and sin and death do not have the last word. You can grapple with those questions. I hope you do. But we, even preachers, did you know that? Even guys who get paid to work at a church and stand on the stage for a living grapple with difficult questions. I get annoyed with how Christians interact with the world. I get annoyed with how Christians vote and what they post on Facebook. And I want to argue and fight about that, but that's not the point at the end of the day. Did Jesus rise from the dead or not? Some of you are like, I'm not sure. That's okay. I'm glad you're here. And there's plenty of places to explore that. I can give you plenty of book recommendations or resources. In fact, today we have a book that we're going to give to every family. Before you leave, make sure you go to the welcome table and grab it. It's called The Case for Easter. And it's about the logic and the truth claims regarding the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Don't leave without grabbing one of those. It's just a really short overview of some of the basic data. In the back of the book, there's this section about the sinner's prayer, and there's some good stuff in there, but if you are convinced, if you read that book and you're like, I need to have a conversion experience, come back and talk to one of us, because there's some things that we want to explain in more detail than what the book does in the back. But you skip that page and come talk to me or Steve or one of the elders. So if you came in skeptical, explore with us. Explore. If you came in discouraged and disoriented and disappointed, well, today can be the second half of that 14-mile walk. It can be the second seven. It can be the half where you pray, God, would you reveal your son to us? Would you reveal your goodness and your truth to us? Today can be that second mile walk. He is not here. He is risen. We're going to sing a song in closing. We're going to sing that song called Death Was Arrested because I like it. And I want you to like it too. But because it tells the truth about what we've gathered here to celebrate today, that our lives are not contained within the 70, 80, 90 years that we will have beating hearts and lungs filling and deflating with air, but that our lives will last from here to forever because of what Jesus did, because he conquered death.